I'm Dick Gordon. Coming up, the story of one man's improbable experience witnessing change at the height of political leadership and then having the chance to make change at the grassroots level. Kwaku Ture was in high school and college when Jesse Jackson made his two runs for leadership of the Democratic Party. Kwaku had grown up listening to the charismatic political preaching of Reverend Jackson.
I am somebody. I am somebody. I may be poor, but I am somebody.
Through some chance, Kwaku Ture found himself just out of college, working as the number one roadman for Reverend Jackson. It thrust him into an orbit of senior political leadership he'd never imagined he'd see. But in the past 20 years, Kwaku's worked much closer to the ground, helping teenagers at risk. I'll talk with him about where he thinks real change comes from after the news. If there's one word that marks this political season, it's change. Even as the votes were still being counted in yesterday's primaries, the Democratic hopeful Barack Obama stood before a large crowd underlining the need for change.
Our time has come. Our movement is real. And change is coming to America.
In many cases, it's working for him, but people who stand with Hillary Clinton say they're not so sure.
The idea of change, without any real substance, it seemed to me, underneath that, convinced me that I think Hillary has more substance in what she has to say.
This is not the first time that people have been drawn to the flame of change. Darnell Ford found himself caught up with Reverend Jesse Jackson in the heady days of his push for power, and he's had a lot of time since then to think about where real change comes from. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
Back in 1988, Darnell Ford had not yet changed his name to Kwaku Ture, going back to his African roots. Darnell was just a junior at Virginia State during the election of that year, an election that saw Reverend Jesse Jackson make his second run within the Democratic Party.
You got a choice. Somebody got to rise above race, rise above sex, a new leadership, a choice, a chance. Don't cry about what you don't have. Use what you got.
Darnell Ford did not get caught up in the politics of that time. He wasn't to know that 3 years later he'd find himself in a fancy Washington hotel suite as Jesse Jackson's chief roadman, hobnobbing with none other than Nelson Mandela.
And it happened like everything else happened when I was with him. He never tells me. He said, we're going somewhere real quick. And he just took me to this hotel, and Nelson was in town, and next thing you know, I'm in a suite shaking hands with Nelson Mandela, and Reverend is joking with me. There's a picture of myself and being introduced to Nelson, and Reverend smiling and laughing, you know, like we're just meeting an old buddy. It was just amazing. And I was surprised because Nelson was tall. Nelson's 6'4", I'm 6'5", Reverend's 6'4". So it was just like three big guys, just, you know. And that's how all of my moments happened with him. They were just nonchalant. Wasn't no grandiose thing.
In fact, it all started when Darnell Ford was broke, living at home with his mother, and she told him he needed to get a job, so he got up one hot summer morning in 1990 and dressed in his job hunting clothes.
My blue blazer and my stripy shirt and my loafers with holes in them, and I walked from 13th and oldest place Northwest D.C. downtown and said, hi, my name is Darnell Ford, and I'm a graduate of Virginia State University, and I'm looking for work. And I did that about at least 15 times before lunch.
And where were you? You were in senators' offices or lobbyist offices? What kind of...
Well, actually, Jesse's office was at 2020 M Street, Northwest D.C. I walked in, and I sat in the lobby because I was so tired, and my feet were hurting, and didn't eat, didn't have any money.
I bet you were hot, too.
Yeah, it was hot. I was sweating. And this large woman, she was very beautiful, but she was very large, walked in. And I said, excuse me, my name is Darnell Ford. I'm looking for work. Is there any place in here where I can find a job? And she said, come on, baby. I have a place you go. You know Jesse's office is in this building. I said, oh, yeah, Jesse.
You knew automatically she was talking about Reverend Jackson.
Yeah, because okay. That's what we say, Jesse, when they say that. So I followed her upstairs, and she gave me something to eat, actually. I told her my story, and she said, well, we don't have any work, and Reverend's out of town. I'm the office manager. My name is Carolyn Hunter, and you can help us out, just volunteer. So I said, okay. And he had this room. The room was about 15 by 15, and it was full of mail that was unanswered. So the next day, I came back, and I went into that room, and I closed the door, and I organized the mail by states.
It was just sitting around in piles before that.
He had mail, thousands of unopened mail from Idaho, Wyoming, people who were in prison in Japan, people who were in prison in Africa. So I just created these mail slots, and I hand wrote a title on the door, Donnell Ford, Constituency Services Volunteer Administrator, some crazy title.
That's very clever. Okay.
And Reverend wasn't there, and the major staff wasn't there. I guess Reverend was off doing what he does. I started there on a Tuesday, and around that Thursday, I met the rest of the senior staff. Lorraine Westbrook, I'll never forget her. The air conditioning broke down in the building, so they called the air conditioning repair person for the building. And this tall black man with dreadlocks showed up, and everyone assumed he was the air conditioning repair man, and he wasn't. He was actually a guy off of the street walking around with tools, and he would go into these office buildings and pretend he was a maintenance person, and then he would steal out of the purses. So about 20 minutes after he was there, I heard this loud scream. Stop that guy. Stop that guy. He's stealing. He's stealing. He's stealing purses. He's stealing purses.
This was Lorraine or Carolyn? Who was calling?
This is Lorraine. Lorraine Westbrook. She was about 5 feet even and pudgy. And all I saw was her running by me. And then I saw the guy at the front entrance trying to escape. So myself and another guy, we jumped him and hogtied him. But this guy was big. This guy was my size. I'm 6'5". This guy was about 6'4". And we hogtied him from the neck with an extension cord. And that rope from his neck went to the back of his legs.
This guy wasn't going anywhere.
He wasn't going anywhere. So a lot of my street skills from D.C. kicked in on that day.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Darnell Ford made the evening news that night and pretty soon caught the attention of Reverend Jackson himself.
I guess I was doing the mail, and I saw him walk by, and he just glanced at me, and he didn't say anything, and he kept walking. And this was around lunchtime. He called me into his office and looked me up and down and asked me some questions, and I told him I was an alpha man, and he was an omega man. These are black fraternities. And he said, well, you know, this is not my first time helping an alpha man, because Dr. King was an alpha. And, you know, the next thing I know, he said, what are you doing this evening? I said, not much. He said, I want you to go with me to New York. I said, okay. Now, I'm saying this calmly now, but I said it calmly in front of him. But when I went back to the office and shut the door, just was jumping for joy and was just, you know, just happy. Now, remember, I'm not being paid. I'm just a volunteer. So the next thing you know, that evening, I ended up flying with him on a Trump shuttle to New York.
Wait a second here. You're how old at this point?
I guess I was about 22 years old.
22 years old, and mm-hmm. You're on this private plane with Jesse Jackson, who, if we need to go back to 1990, I mean, this guy had just run for president in 1984 and 1988. He had a really high profile at that time.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
When we got on the Trump shuttle, and he placed me in the seat beside him, and he fell asleep, that's when I just kept staring at him and seeing if it was real. And I couldn't believe it, that I was there holding his satchel, him taking me to New York on a trip, and I was just totally shocked. And when we arrive, we get into this limousine, and lo and behold, Percy Sutton and Bill Cosby and Lou Rawls were the next people I met. I mean, I couldn't describe it. I can't even remember how we got to the Apollo Theater. But the next thing I know, from the Trump shuttle that evening, I was at the Apollo Theater at backstage. It was like I was just one of the boys. You know, they knew I was naive and I was young, you know, and Reverend, I guess, was still interviewing me because he still hadn't offered me a job.
Did you even know at this point that you were under consideration for a real job with Reverend Jackson?
When we left that night on the plane, he gave me the rundown. He was like, I like the way you handle yourself. You don't stargaze. I want to hire you. Go with me. Be my road manager. And at this time, I was like, oh, this is what it is. Oh, okay, I can do that. I said, yes, sir. I'll be willing. I never asked about the money. That was the thing. I never asked about the money. But I was hoping that he would pay me $20,000 a year. I was just hoping and praying that he did. So my friend Jeanette that worked in the building told me that I should take no less than $24,000 a year. So I went into his office with my chest out and everything. I said, Reverend, I would like to make $24,000 a year. And he said, okay. So it wasn't much of a negotiation.
You should have asked for more.
Right. And to my surprise, when I got my check, I was making $25,000 or $26,000 a year. He had bumped it up. It turned out that the going salary for a person that's traveling with somebody all the time and you're the road manager is about $25,000 to $30,000 a year. So I lowballed myself.
Hey, I want to know what it was like when you went home and told your mother that you'd been hired as Reverend Jesse Jackson's number one guy and you're making like more money than she ever made in her life. What was that conversation like?
It was amazing because she started to cry a little bit and she got on the phone and called all of her friends. And when I went to church with her, everyone at the church knew that I was working for Jesse Jackson, the pastor, everyone. And I didn't know that she could work the phones. She worked the phones better than the people at the office. It was a proud moment. I think she was more proud of me then than when I actually graduated from college.
Darnell Ford says the work was a lot more than just celebrity gazing for him. He says Reverend Jackson would draw him into conversations and ask his opinion. So Darnell was watching political leaders figure out ways to make change. And I'll talk with him about what he learned and what came after that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. On a day when the American political landscape is shifting and with everyone anticipating some kind of change, I'm talking with a man who had his own window in on the kind of change that political leaders can bring. Some years ago, my guest changed his name to Kwaku Ture, but back in 1990, he was still Darnell Ford and still working at the elite level of politics as the road manager with Jesse Jackson.
It meant the world to me. I admired him, and I still do, tremendously. And what it also meant to me was that I got to do what I wanted to do when I was in college, which was be a social activist, a race leader. So meeting Reverend just was the cherry on top. I was going to try to relive what happened in the 60s, but place a little twist on it in the 80s and 90s. I was going to be the new Malcolm, the new Patrice Lumumba. I was going to try to be the new James Farmer, and I was going to study under one of the greatest.
And tell me if you had a chance to do that kind of studying, that if you had that interaction with Reverend Jackson, because you'll know that a lot of people who do this kind of work, you know, will stand outside the lobby waiting to flag the limo from across the street because the boss is ready to go. Did you have time, you know, sitting in airport lobbies or traveling with Reverend Jackson to pick his brain about the time that he spent with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. or about his ideas of social justice.
Absolutely. Every day. And that was the unique thing behind my relationship with him, that he really taught me. When I met with him privately, I mean, he would talk about the days with Martin and when he met Malcolm. And we played one-on-one basketball, and when we played one-on-one basketball with each other, he would tell me these stories. And when we would fly from campaigns, he would just say, okay, what did you learn today? And I would, even though if I was wrong, he would never say you were wrong. He said, okay, apply that to when we were in Georgia 2 weeks ago. And the most significant thing I learned is when we were in Miami and the Haitian boat people were being encamped and turned down in Miami. And he was on that mission. And there were like 10,000 people at this protest. And he told me to do something. And I didn't do it exactly the way he wanted me to do it. And he chastised me. And 2 days later, he came back and he said, I know why you did it that way, but you should have did it this way, and here's why. And that's when I knew that he didn't really consider me as just a regular employee. He really cherished the relationship we had. So some staff were threatened and upset that I was a new fresh face, and he would take me places that they weren't able to go.
Do you remember what it was on that day in Miami that got you into a bit of trouble with the boss?
Yeah, I do, but I can't tell you.
Tell me why you can't tell me. I'll go that far with you.
Well, there are some things when you work close with someone that you just don't do, you know. And I still admire the man, and he's a great one. But when you're working that close with someone, there's some things leadership have to do that they just have to do. And we had a lot of those moments, and this is just one of those moments.
You're saying things happened on the road that require a level of discretion that even now, 18 years after the fact, you wouldn't betray that trust.
Right.
Darnell says the Reverend Jackson had a nickname for him. He called him Big Country. Darnell recalls the daily travels of Jesse Jackson took them both to Europe and to Africa and across the U.S.
And the zenith of that whole experience was when he introduced me to Nelson Mandela. And it happened like everything else happened when I was with him. He never tells me. He said, we're going somewhere real quick. He never tells. I see, you know, we had this printed schedule, but there's really generic stuff on the schedule. And he just took me to this hotel, and Nelson was in town. And next thing you know, I'm in a suite shaking hands with Nelson Mandela, and Reverend is joking with me. There's a picture of myself and being introduced to Nelson, and Reverend smiling and laughing because he called me Big Country. This is Big Country. He won't be a lawyer just like you. And but I told him, you know, he's an alpha man, and just joking and laughing, you know, like we're just meeting an old buddy. And it was just amazing. And I was surprised because Nelson was tall. Nelson's 6'4", I'm 6'5", Reverend's 6'4". So it was just like three big guys, just, you know. And that's how all of my moments happened with him. They were just nonchalant. There was no grandiose thing, you know. And I think he liked that about me, that I wasn't like the other road managers he had. I didn't carry a camera. I didn't ask for autographs. It's just those moments were there.
Here's a question, though. I mean, if you're traveling at that elite level, learning as much as you are, meeting such interesting people, why did you ever stop? Why did you want to leave?
I thought it was time for me to move on. That I saw myself becoming like the rest of the staff. I saw myself starting working for him as opposed to working with him.
I don't understand the distinction. See if you can explain that.
When you're working for someone, you're not really doing what you want to do out of your heart. But when you're working with someone, you're doing it because you love it and you know that you're helping people. When we started, we were a team, and then it ended up that I just became an employee. And that's when I decided to leave.
You've had some time to think about it since then. Looking back on it, what changed? What was the moment when you thought, no, this isn't really what I want to do?
Basically, after we came back from Africa, the misery and despair I saw there was sort of the same misery and despair I saw in the United States. And I didn't have a chance to kind of deal with that. And I wanted to go off and just deal with that. And then there was a moment we were on a train after we came back from Africa, and I was reading Black Capitalism, and I was chuckling, and he leaned over and he said, "What are you chuckling about?" And I said, this guy wrote this about Malcolm X in this book I'm reading." And he said, "What's that?" And I said, "Black Capitalism." And the guy basically said that when young Black youth graduate from college, instead of them going back in the Black community working for their moms and dads at the mom and pop stores, they take their degrees and go work for, try to get jobs, government, or try to get jobs working for private industry, and the Black community loses that knowledge. You can't hardly find a Black mom and pop store in the Black community anymore. And he looked at me and he said, Malcolm was one of the people when he said something, he didn't really motivate people to do things. But when Martin spoke, he motivated people to do things. And I sort of disagreed with his comments and so forth. And it was one of his moments where he was trying to educate me on, you know, what should be the motivating factor behind you doing something for a community. And I sort of disagreed. And that's when I knew, when I started to disagree with him.
Yeah. I remember an instance. I was pretty young, probably in my early 30s, when I started traveling around with, at the time, the Canadian Prime Minister. And, you know, we'd go to places like India and South Africa and Indonesia and Pakistan and stuff like that. And we'd land and we'd stay in a hotel and we'd cover a news conference and we'd be back in the bus and then we'd leave. And I remember feeling like, wow, I didn't get a chance to see this country. I don't really know how the people right here live. I wonder if part of the sort of pace that you were keeping with Reverend Jackson was getting to you, in that you were never getting a chance to get below the surface. You're never getting a chance to sort of pause and say, wow, what's really going on with these people's lives here?
That's exactly it. That was about 50% of what went through my head when I resigned. And part of the other thing is when I just didn't agree with some of the things that we did politically. I'm not wedded to the Democratic Party, so, you know, I couldn't understand why we were wedded to the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
But, that was exactly it, Dick. That was it.
He had invested, over the years that you spent together, a fair amount of trust in you. How easy was it for you to say to Reverend Jackson, "I'm done"?
It wasn't as easy as I thought. I knew that we were close, but when I told him, he was upset and it hurt a little bit. And, you know, I've only seen him once, maybe twice since then, but I was trying to go to law school. And mind you, I had not even pulled an application to go to law school, but I knew I could not do that and be with him. When you're working for Reverend, you got to work for him every day, all day. So just pulling applications was just difficult. Yeah. So I had to make a clean break.
We have that photo of Reverend Jackson and Nelson Mandela and my guest Darnell Ford on our website at thestory.org. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As Darnell was telling me, he was wondering if he was becoming too comfortable in those leather seats traveling first class. And that's where he told Reverend Jackson he was quitting.
We were on an airplane coming from somewhere, and I don't remember where, but I do remember his facial expression. And he always puts his finger in the air when he wants to make a point. And he made a point to me. He did not like
what did
me
say?
Telling him. I can't tell you exactly what.
Give me a paraphrased version of it.
Well, be careful what you wish for.
Huh. Did he feel like, in a way, you were betraying him?
You know, it turned, and see, that's the thing about a dynamic person like him. Yeah, it turned that way. I think he had to do it that way in order to make a clean break himself.
He's got time to love you and to trust you, but he doesn't have time to... there's no middle ground. It's right, love or hate, right? Those words are too strong, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah,
right?
They're too strong, yeah. You know, he was still, you know, although I haven't seen him but once or twice since then, but I don't think he... I think when someone tells you they want to leave you, you can't really... I mean, he had a whole organization to run and a family to feed, and, you know, so he couldn't worry about just one particular guy leaving him.
Yeah.
So, you know, it hurt, but it was just a moment I felt that I had to leave.
Did you have second thoughts when you realized that by telling him you wanted to go, you'd upset him?
Yeah, I had a second thought maybe a day after, and then about 2 weeks after when I wasn't receiving any more money.
That always gets your attention, doesn't it?
Yeah. When I was broke, I didn't have a job. And my wife at the time was like, well, maybe you ought to go back and get your job with Jesse. And I was like, no.
And looking back on it now, were you right to step away and to get back down to the grassroots?
Absolutely. He helped me in two facets. If you look at my resume and how I built my professional career, I never worked for anyone more than 5 years. You know, I worked in housing for like 4 or 5 years. I worked with prisoners in D.C., people on parole and probation 4 or 5 years. But I always saw my jobs as initiatives or projects. And what I don't like is that when you're talented and young and you stay somewhere for 20 to 15 years and you look up and you become part of the institution or the bureaucracy. Part of the problem, actually. So what I've done, I've carefully crafted my professional career in a way that I have these political initiatives that I've accomplished. You know, making sure that people got housing, making sure people got food and jobs and drug treatment programs. And I think I've been more satisfied in my soul doing that.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. Darnell Ford said he went to Africa, and while he was there, he met a woman in Ghana, and later they married, and it was around that time that he changed his own name to Kwaku Ture. Now, Kwaku remembers thinking to himself that of all the people, even in his wife's hometown in Ghana, 500 or 600 of them needed new shoes, and that was the sort of practical thing he could do. Back in the United States, Kwaku has worked with kids in juvenile justice programs and as the manager of a soup kitchen. He even ran once for city council in D.C. So when Kwaku hears people now talk about Hillary and Huckabee and Obama and each one of their promises for change, he says he makes the point that no one person is able to bring that kind of change.
Well, I would say that, you know, we're waiting on the savior, a savior, just... anyone, whether you're Republican or independent, I would say that there are enough resources just in this room to change things. I had the same conversation. I was invited to speak at Howard University a few years ago, and that's what I basically told the class, was that voter registration is important and everyone should vote, but if you go from door to door in a particular neighborhood, you could find resources and an after-school program. There's an after-school program for kids, for latchkey kids in every neighborhood. There's some grandmother or some aunt or some guy in the neighborhood that has some skill, whether they're a carpenter or a plumber, that you can probably tailor-make a after-school program behind that talent. If you just took an inventory in your neighborhood, that could prevent crime. But everyone's vested in this idea if you vote for someone, then they're going to make a decision to bring resources to your community, and then a program will start that way, when the program that may start that way may not even fit the culture of your community.
So are you cynical about national or international level of politics or politicians or leaders in terms of the kind of change that can come from them?
No, I'm not cynical, but just politicians and leaders nationally and internationally, I'm not cynical, but I am frustrated with the idea that if you vote for me, I could make the world happen for you And that's not, I'm not faulting the leadership for that.
Well, we all get caught up in the sort of cult of political celebrity, don't we?
Yeah. I mean, because you could pick any neighborhood in Washington, D.C., Chicago, L.A., or New York. If they look hard enough, there's enough resources, enough talent to change things.
You know, that was a time that if someone told you to do something, you did it. Bam, right on. And there were no questions asked. It was yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. You never said no. Oh, but things are changing, folks. Yeah, it's a new day, baby. A brand new day. And folks now want to take their lives into their own hands and make their own choices. No longer do they want to go along with the program because everybody says right, see? Folks just want to do their own thing. Now, you know what I mean? Different stroke for different folk. Let me tell you what I'm talking about. I don't want no gold box for working 50 years from 9 to 5. Oh, while my boss is guzzling champagne.
This is one of those men that Kwaku Ture met, Lou Rawls, with one of his better-known songs, A Natural Man. Now, there was one neighborhood in D.C. where Kwaku Ture made the kind of change he's talking about, involving a group of kids who'd already been through the juvenile justice system. Tough kids. And the kind of transformation Kwaku says he'll never forget. I'll have him tell me that story in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story.
A natural man. Well, I refuse to listen.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. At a time when we're hearing so much about change, my guest today is someone who has seen that kind of power to make change from the very top and also from the bottom. Kwaku Ture spent a couple of years with Reverend Jesse Jackson as his road manager, and he saw the kind of power that elite political leaders can wield, and that impressed him. But Kwaku spent the past 18 years working in neighborhoods where people needed more direct help, and that kind of power, he says, is something we don't acknowledge readily enough. I asked Kwaku to tell me about the one time when he saw that most clearly.
That moment came when I was working with a group of youth who were adjudicated out of the D.C. Superior Court. And it was a rites of passage program.
These are tough kids.
And kids who had previously been incarcerated or in trouble, and the judge sent them to us, about 25 of them.
How old were they?
Between 14 and 17.
Okay.
The whole thing was introducing them to an African motif and the Nguza Saba principles from Kwanzaa and teaching them a different philosophy of being at peace and not committing crimes and so forth. And at the end, it all culminated into a graduation ceremony. And this moment is so clear. We were on Georgia Avenue in D.C., and I marched them with African regalia for about 2 miles from one African Senate school up to their graduation point through a drug-infested area in D.C. And we had drums and dancers, and it was just 12 or 15 boys that were graduating holding staffs, like 6-foot staffs, that they made and wearing African clothes, and we were marching up Georgia Avenue. And at that moment, I knew I had made the right decision.
And these tough street kids that you're marching through, they're kind of like their former stomping ground. They're dressed in the kind of wraps and sarongs that might be seen in Africa today, and they're not in any way self-conscious. They're not going, oh, man, I hope nobody sees me who knows me. I mean...
And that's the thing. Part of the whole process was that we gave them African names. So not only had I changed my name, part of the process was me taking them through a transformation ceremony where they also changed their name. So they entered the program Robert Smith or John Lester or Calvin Butts. But when they left, they were Kwaku. They were Aminifu. They had African names. And we reintroduced them to society where they used to sell drugs and gangbang on those particular corners. Yeah. And they met their parents at the end of the march. And we said, here's your son. It was like a moment from Roots, basically.
So what did you see? I mean, what was it about that? Was it when they met their parents, or was it watching them walk past their former street corners? What was that?
It was watching them walk past their former street corners, and some of the people recognized them and looked at them differently. They had admiration and respect for them. Like, people stopped selling drugs and stopped doing what they were doing just to watch us march down the street. And we had no permit. You know, this wasn't a government-sponsored program from the D.C. government. And Dick, the difference between that and when I was with Jesse probably would have been invited to the ceremony at something like that. So, you know, when you were Reverend, he would get invited to speak at a ceremony like that. And he would plug in, you know, what the nation needed to do in order to, which is rightfully so. He would plug in, you know, the government needs to do this and the government needs to do that. But the surreal moment for me was being part of that whole process and changing those boys' lives. And that's when I knew I made the right decision.
Kweku Ture eventually realized his dream of going to law school. He's there now. He'll graduate in 2009. Now, a note here, Kweku volunteered his story, simply wrote me a note. And you can do exactly the same thing. Go to our website at thestory.org. Just leave me a couple of lines about a story that you think will work here, and we'll get back to you. Confession time. I started today's show listening back to Reverend Jesse Jackson's campaign rhetoric from 20 years ago. I remember that. It was good. It stuck with me. I want to hear it one more time.
I am somebody. I am somebody. I may be poor, but I am somebody. I am black, beautiful, proud. I must be respected. I must be protected. I am God's child. What time is it? When we stand together, what time is it? When we say no more yes to boss, what time is it? What time is it?
It is time for one more political story of a lesson learned. This one comes directly from the Generation Y voters who are so engaged in this year's campaigning. Camille Santoki got involved in politics when she was 18 years old. Now, this was the primary season leading up to the last election in 2004. Camille was in her second year at UC Santa Barbara, and she became a volunteer for Dennis Kucinich.
A friend of my mother's went to, like, a political dinner and met Kucinich and just started raving about him. And I just started doing research on him. I checked out his website. I went to a bunch of Los Angeles meetings where his other supporters were. And I just really became inspired by him.
Well, what was it something about Kucinich himself, his campaign, his ideas, the way the man looks? I mean, what drew you in?
It was definitely the stuff he was saying. It really resonated with me because, I mean, I was young, but I had watched the news and stuff, and I was so sick of hearing those vague responses that political candidates always give. You know, they talk about the kind of campaign they want to have or what general, you know, ideas they have, change, hope, but they don't have an exact plan. And what I liked about Kucinich is he would say exactly what he was going to do. Back in the 2003 primary time, he was saying, I want to get us out of Iraq within 90 days. He had like a deadline.
Right.
And he's like, and these are the exact steps I'm going to do. I'm going to talk to the UN. I'm going to get these countries on board. And I mean, he just had this very specific plan. And I really liked that. And he had no like corporate backing whatsoever. So it really felt like he was like a man of actual people.
So it wasn't just a sort of intellectual interest. You got caught up with this guy.
I got really caught up with this guy. You know, this is my summer at home. I'm from Los Angeles. So it was my summer in the city talking to people about it. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go back to school in the fall at UC Santa Barbara. And I'm going to get this whole Kucinich movement started in Santa Barbara. That was my plan. To plant seeds, to start the grassroots movement.
Now, so was there a Democratic Party on campus? Was there a place where you could go and say, all right, you know, Kucinich volunteers and supporters gather here, let's make
a
plan?
Well, that's what my job became. I went to meetup.com and found the Kucinich group there, which was really big in Los Angeles, so I figured there'd be a Santa Barbara branch. And I went to that, and it was like maybe 7 people. They were all old. There was one other like punk rocker guy who was my age.
And you're looking around and you're thinking to yourself, what at this point?
7 people? I mean, Santa Barbara is not, you know, a big city, but it's like, you know, it's a big, you know,
yeah, and it's supposed to be fairly progressive. And Kucinich is putting himself out as this progressive guy.
Right? Yeah, and it's really progressive too. So I met these Kucinich people and I was like, okay, you know what? Me and this one other guy, we were going to start the movement. And so I got some bumper stickers and I got like a big banner and I took it home. I was going to start doing tabling on campus. And first I went to the campus Democrat meeting and I was like, okay, campus Democrat meeting, like maybe there's going to be some Kucinich supporters there. Maybe, you know, there'll be people who don't know who they're going to vote for yet and I can get them on board with me.
So you're thinking even if people at that point are leaning towards Kerry or Clark, you're going to be able to talk them into joining you on the Kucinich
campaign. Yeah, I didn't know like if the campus Democrat meeting, if everyone had I'd never been politically involved before. What I came to realize though was there was no political scene because I showed up to this campus Democrat meeting and there's like literally 15 people there. And Santa Barbara's a school of like around an undergraduate population alone of like 20,000 students.
And I remember people saying that, you know, college students were getting caught up in the 2004 election. I'm surprised that so few people were there.
My experience was that, you know, there's a lot of other things to do besides become involved politically.
It's like go to the beach.
Our campus is literally on the ocean.
Yeah.
And I loved my academic department. I'm a proud alumna of Santa Barbara. But, you know, in terms of political activity, you know, people would rather hang out on the beach than maybe discuss politics.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Camille was determined. She was convinced that she could help her fellow students also get excited about Dennis Kucinich. And so here she is at that meeting of young Democrats.
Literally, maybe half of the group was over the age of 40, which is really confusing for me. Because I was like, where, what? Okay, what's going on?
Yeah.
And like, I was the only person from Kucinich there. And so each person from each political campaign got up and gave a little speech on their candidate. And I gave this like very from the heart speech. I poured my heart out to the crowd. And literally, the dean people started hissing at me at one point.
You're kidding me.
I couldn't believe it. Like, I mean, I couldn't believe that it was older people and the dean people were hissing at me. So I didn't gain any supporters from that meeting. Though it was funny, the president of College Dems came up to me afterwards and said, you know, I thought you gave the most heartfelt speech, but she whispered it in my ear.
She didn't want anyone else to know.
She didn't want anyone else to know. She whispered in my ear. She goes, I thought you gave the best speech. And I was like, oh, you want to get on board my campaign? And she goes, no, I'm the campus Democrat president. I can't get involved in any campaign.
So you're still enthusiastic at this point. What do you do next?
So then I start tabling, and I go, okay, you know what? Those college Democrats, like, they're so jaded. I just need to reach out to the people who aren't politically involved, like I had been myself. I will go out, and I'll talk to people, and once they talk to me and they hear the logical facts, they'll be interested and they'll get excited too, because I was so excited. I had my Kucinich banner and my bumper stickers and a little email sheet, and I would just ask passersby, excuse me, what do you think of America? Like, what are your political beliefs? I just want to talk, you know? And maybe about 70% of the people that walked by me were wearing their iPods and just didn't stop to talk.
Even if they heard you, they were pretending they were
listening. They were plugged in. And then the people who would respond would be like, I really don't care. Or Kucinich, I've never heard of him. I got to go to class. Very like lukewarm reception. The few people that would actually talk to me, they would agree with me on the points that I would make, but they wouldn't want to get involved because they saw him, because the media portrayed him as this left-wing radical candidate. They couldn't even get involved with him because the media had just like almost
labeled him as unelectable from
labeled him as unelectable. Yeah. And so, therefore, it was stupid to even discuss him.
And so, as this is going on, is your own enthusiasm for the guy getting worn down? Or are you getting more pumped about it?
I mean, it made me depressed because I was so enthused about him. But the reactions I was getting from my peers, you know, this is the group I was a member of. This is my contemporaries. And they were just rejecting him.
How much time were you out there?
I would spend maybe 3 times a week for a couple hours.
Yeah.
So nothing outrageous, but, you know, I put my time in.
Did anybody give you an email address?
I mean, I got a couple, but I would email people about helping out to volunteer, and then no one would really respond. Like they say with any political campaign, you know, the first people you got to get on board are your family and friends. And so, like, my mom and my sister were on board, and my close friends were on board. I mean, my close friends went out and voted for Kucinich just for me. But it didn't feel like they weren't impassioned to speak out. They were, like, doing it almost as a favor because they, you know, were close to me.
And so what happened? I mean, did you drift away? Did you fall out of love with the guy? Or
I just stopped tabling because when Kerry rose to the top, he was like this wall force. It just became overnight. Suddenly he was the candidate, and that was that. And there was no other competition. By the time it got to California, it was already decided. Everyone knew it was going to be Kerry by the time it got to California. And I remember on campaign day, I was just kind of depressed sitting in my apartment, you know, because, like, Kerry, of all those candidates, to me, was the least inspiring. He had that staunch air to him. So I just remember saying to my roommates, listen, it doesn't matter. Kerry's already got it. Just vote for Kucinich to just make a statement that there is a progressive political community. Some people do care about having a anti-war candidate. Because that's what Kucinich was to me. He was the, like, only candidate who consistently voted against the war. And that's what I liked about him, was his consistency in being a peace man.
Camille Santocchi is talking with me about her passion for Denis Kucinich in 2004. You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. As we all know now, Kucinich didn't make it in 2004, and he didn't make it in this campaign season either. In fact, he probably gathered more media attention this time around with his new wife, Elizabeth, a woman 30 years younger than him. But this is a story about Camille. What happened to her enthusiasm?
You know, honestly, to me, my closeness to the Kucinich campaign, it's like, you know, getting out of a relationship with a boyfriend. You can't just, I mean, I guess some people do rebound. You know, there will be those people out there that as soon as they break up with a boy, just rush into their next relationship. But I'm not that kind of girl. I need time to recover. And frankly, that's what happened. You know, I got out of that Kucinich campaign, and it was almost like I didn't even want to be involved with the Bush-Kerry election because it was too sad for me.
So what do you do when the boyfriend comes back? Because Kucinich returned for this campaign.
I know, campaign. He did. And it was very weird for me. As they say, I had gotten over him and I had moved on. And I have a much more callous attitude towards politics now. I remember he was in Esquire. And they had a really, like, cheesy photo shoot of him and his 29-year-old wife, who's this, like, really pretty Irish girl who's, like, 2 feet taller than him. And they're, like, making out on a carousel in this photo shoot.
You're just jealous, Camille.
I don't know. I mean, you know, I always thought of Kucinich as a father figure, not as as boyfriend material, but apparently he dates in my age range. But I just remember thinking, like, Esquire photo shoot with, like, a makeout? Like, this is not serious, Kucinich. I couldn't get behind him at all this time because to present yourself like that, I mean, everyone knows, in politics, image is everything. To have him presenting himself in a way that was just, like, totally laughable upset me because it was like he had thrown in the towel before the game had started. So to me, it was like, if you're not going to take this seriously, I can't take you seriously.
Okay, so help me with something then, Camille. You're, what, 22, 23 years old?
I'm 23. I'll be 24 next month.
And, you know, there are a lot of people your age who are passionately caught up in the election this time around. As the numbers are crunched and people rise and fall, are we going to see a lot of people just give up on politics because their person didn't make it through?
I think that a lot of people are going to be upset. I especially feel like the supporters of the Obama campaign have this, like, Obama mania that I don't know where that energy is going to go if he doesn't get the nomination. So that should be interesting. And I mean, this is, like, literally happening this week.
People get so passionate about one candidate that, you know, as was the case with you, it's kind of hard to transfer that allegiance overnight and you know, become a loyal supporter of the person who, you know, just hours ago was the enemy.
Exactly, who you were literally trying to speak badly of.
Yeah.
You know, you were purposefully saying bad things about them, you know, like back-talking them, you know, to then jump on their ship is just, I personally can't do that, you know, in relationships, both political and personal.
Camille, thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you so much.
Camille Santoki now works as a TV producer in Hollywood. If you have your own personal story about your affair with politics or that curious mix of political passion and just plain passion, you can get in touch with me at our website. I'm at thestory.org, or leave me a message on my phone line at 1-888-966-9862, 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.